Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 1:17, and that is Pacific Summer Time. And today, it being Friday, July 29th, it's the big picture long-term audio for the various different asset classes. And this has been a data-rich day. In the morning, the Japanese came in a reflective mood with the Bank of Japan saying that they need to reflect on the efficacy of their policy, or their perhaps not efficacy but effectiveness of their policies, because they've been adopting both quantitative easing and negative interest rates concurrently, and then that's not exactly ideal, because obviously printing money or lending money into existence is inflationary, while charging money people to take it is deflationary. So therefore, the problems that that creates is that you mess with the economy, you create imbalances, but you don't get the result that you want in terms of growth. And rather interesting that the ECB is facing a very similar prospect. They have done just about everything bar throw the kitchen sink at this problem, and yet they haven't yet achieved their goals, which means that they're going to have to get more extraordinary in terms of the policies that they are willing to adopt. Having been one of the countries that went for quantitative easing most aggressively, then Japan perhaps offers a template for what may happen in Europe, because there is absolutely no doubt that Europe faces problems that are potentially far greater than those that face Japan. There is nobody talking about Japan breaking up as a country. There is certainly a demographic problem in Japan, and they are dealing with it in their own way, but at the same time, and do they have a lot of debt? Absolutely they do, but most of that debt is held internally, and they still have a trade surplus. So Japan has got problems for sure, but does it have problems that can't be fixed by the correct set of policies and I guess the willingness to implement them? Probably not. Whereas Europe, there is very much a question of whether, doesn't matter what policies that they introduce, if they can't get the people to go with them, then it might all be for naught. So what happens in Japan might well, I suspect that they're going to be watching very closely in Frankfurt at what happens with Japan. And Japan is now at the point where they are likely, or at least common sense would dictate, that they abandon the negative interest rate policy and rather go for direct transfers, skip the banking sector, and develop some form of helicopter money. That would certainly get the inflation measures moving by simply putting money in people's pockets and ensuring that the value of that money is depreciating rapidly enough that it creates the impetus to spend. And that kind of thing will get will set inflation alight. The problem, of course, is that once you go down that route, the potential for hyperinflation can kick off. There's once that genie is out of the bottle, then interest rates have to go up, and have to go up aggressively in order to address it. So it is obvious that central banks have been incredibly reticent about adopting that kind of policy, because it really is akin to setting the house on fire just to keep warm. And that really is the kind of situation that the central banks find themselves in, because they have some very clear mandates, which are that they need to provide some form of inflation to enhance the potential for growth. In fact, that is the ECB's only mandate. And despite all of the additional responsibilities that it has taken on over the last almost decade, that is its core responsibility, and so far it is failing, because inflation measures within the Eurozone are well shy of 2%. And, of course, the other big data point in here today was that US GDP came in well below expectations at about 1.2% in the second quarter. So then you look at the, and this was also a big week for earnings, and Apple has now pushed back above its 200-day moving average. Microsoft is right at the upper side of its range. Facebook pushed on to new all-time highs and remains in what is a very consistent medium-term uptrend. Amazon firmed within a short-term range and, interestingly, is trading at almost exactly the same price level as Google, which has also firmed within its range and remains within a generally consistent medium-term uptrend, which is defined by these this pattern of one step above another. It's an absolutely excellent example of a staircase step sequence uptrend, and that failed downside break at the lower side of the range about 7 weeks ago is seeing it going right back up to test the upper side of the range. And if one were to simply look at those that small number of mega cap shares, you could be forgiven for thinking that there was anything wrong in the world at all. But of course, what we are presented with is this liquidity-fueled environment, and with GDP figures really hardly setting the world alight in the USA, then the argument for why the Fed should be raising rates in this scenario is going to represent quite a heated argument, because there are going to be the monetary purists, and then there are going to be the rationalists and the realists, and then there are going to be those that are exhibiting caution and looking for overwhelming evidence before they raise rates. And for those people, they'll be looking at the employment figures, they'll be looking at asset prices, and they'll also be looking at wage growth. And I continue to believe that it is wage growth will be the tipping point, because for those people that want to raise, they need evidence that inflation is beginning to regain the upper hand in terms of the data. And the one clear indication of that would be wage growth. Not so much that you have full employment, but that you have more than full employment, because there are people can not only demand higher wages, but they actually get them. And that isn't something that can very simply be hedonicked out of the data. On the other hand, of course, we still have an environment where growth is very weak, where CPI inflation is modest at best, and where the strength of the dollar had until recently acted as a headwind and had done much of the job of tightening all by itself. So it is a very evenly balanced argument, which of course is why the Fed has not raised rates so far this year, is unlikely to raise rates in September, regardless of what wage growth does. But if and because, of course, these are politically nominated bureaucrats, and the last thing they want to do is upset the apple cart when it is their jobs are on the line. Something that we can rely on bureaucrats, regardless of what country they are in, is to do whatever is necessary to ensure their own positions. So the Fed is very unlikely to raise rates in September or October, and that would suggest then that they'd be moving into December before they raise rates, and that is assuming that they decide to raise rates. But of course, it is worth highlighting that the Fed was talking about raising rates four times this year in January, and now it is questionable whether they will raise rates at all. And of course, because we have that that question, then the dollar was weaker in here today. And the pound is up now to 132 and a bit. The euro has rallied back above 110. The yen is now, not only do you have a weaker dollar, but you have the strength in the yen. So that was perhaps the most dynamic move in here today. And that confirms the yen's progression of higher reaction lows, or the dollar's progression of lower rally highs. And this is still a consistent uptrend for the yen, and while 100 yen represents a psychological level for many participants, and not least the Bank of Japan, then it would really require a clear downward dynamic from that area to confirm more than temporary resistance in the region of 100 100 yen to the dollar at this particular point. And with such a large degree of news coming out from both the ECB and the Bank of Japan and the Fed, it is probably worth looking at stock markets because they have been so heavily influenced by the supply of liquidity and the performance of their respective currencies. So the Nikkei is currently hovering there below 17,000, and it needs to get above that 17,000 level before we could really indicate that or get a signal or conclude that demand is back in the driver's seat. And for the DAX in Germany, then it is trading above the 10,000 level. It's above the 200-day moving average, but the progression of lower rally highs is still intact. And it is close to, but hasn't quite broken that progression just yet, and a sustained move above 10,500 would break that progression of lower rally highs. And then the index is currently sitting at 10,337, so there isn't perhaps a great deal to be gained by preempting, because when we look at the DAX, which is a total return index, so it tends to flatter on the upside, or the Stocks 50, or indeed the Euro Stocks, the broad index, and on Bloomberg or on our chart library, that's SXXE, then you're presented with an index that has had a progression of lower rally highs since early 2015 and is now right in the region of the moving average and would absolutely needs to get above it. I don't think you could have a more uncertain environment from the perspective of questions that could be asked with regard to Europe. And yet the stock market has stopped going down. It hasn't really gone down this year. Within this range, it's at towards the upper side of that range. So this is a decision point. This is where we might have some evidence that people are looking at the Eurozone and thinking, okay, yes, there are a lot of problems, so what are likely to be the solutions? And of course, the solution is that they're going to have to print a lot more money. And you know, the argument for fiscal probity, the argument for tighter regulation, and the argument for burning the depositors and the junior bondholders, that's all well and good, but obviously we all want to learn from our mistakes. But of course, the greatest lesson of all is, when is it most appropriate to actually employ those lessons? Because the prescription for fiscal probity and tighter monetary policy, really, this is not the time for it. The time for it was before all of the imbalances were created within the Eurozone. And this is going to come to a head in the not too distant future, because we have the open question of how they are going to enforce this new set of rules for Italy. Italy is a founding member of the EU. It is a founding member of the Eurozone, and it is the third largest economy within the Eurozone. So it is not simply a small country that can get pushed around. And the size of its government debt is such that there's a very simple adage, and it is that if I owe you $10, it's my problem, but if I owe you $1 billion, it's your problem. And that would very much be the case for Italy. The fact that they have such an enormous amount of outstanding debt is everybody's problem. It's not just Italy's problem. And when we look at the ability of some of those peripheral countries to compete, that has been greatly inhibited by the fact that they have adopted the euro. So what is the solution? I don't think anybody has got the patience to wait out the decades that it would take for the fiscal consolidation and return of competitiveness that the bureaucrats in Frankfurt and in Brussels have so far prescribed for much of the periphery. And that would suggest that they're going to require transfers. Now, whether that is fiscal cohesion, whether it is a commitment to continue to bail out their banking sectors, well, then we need some sort of, and I think a lot of voters would need some kind of confidence that that will continue to be the case, because lurching from one crisis to the next is enormously debilitating for sentiment. And then populations are unlikely to accept that as a solution either. And of course, there is a reason that currency devaluation has been the tool of choice for countries for as long as anybody can remember. It's because it's a lot easier than introducing reform and fiscal consolidation without it. Obviously, the best outcome would be to have the ability to devalue the currency and concurrently to adopt a tighter regulatory and sensible regulation way of doing things. But of course, that's all down to governance. And of course, the fact is that a number of these peripheral countries feel that they have lost their ability to influence their governance. And that really does point to the democratic deficit that is evident within the Eurozone. So there is absolutely no question at all that Europe has got a lot of problems, and it is going to require oodles of capital to fix it. And then it is really only a question of where is that money going to come from. And the, I guess then the corollary to that question is whether it is still in Germany's interests to support the euro. And I believe that it is in Germany's interests. And certainly their decision to delay the writing off of some of Greece's debts to beyond the next federal German election is it's an indication that they know that the German population will not vote for that. So they want to kind of keep it quiet until after that election. Of course, an enterprising politician would ensure that it becomes an election issue. And that would suggest that Angela Merkel is in a rather trepidatious situation right now, because she's a year out. Well, I guess it's more like 15 months away from a federal election, and she's been in power for such a long time that there are probably plenty of people who are jolly sick of seeing her face on TV. So that would suggest that we are in for at least another year and a half of uncertainty within the Eurozone, because it isn't just Germany that has elections, it's also France. And that also helps to indicate that, you know, we're in a position where populism could really become an issue for Europe. So when we look at stocks, then there are a large number of political questions relating to Europe. And so far, the reason that the euro has been so reasonably steady, particularly over the balance of the year so far, the reason that the stock market in Europe has been largely range-bound for the year so far is because there is the difference between politics and policy. Because policy, regardless of all the questions, continues to support the Eurozone project. And the ECB has got a blank checkbook, and it has been writing checks with alacrity. So they really are doing whatever it is that they can. They're talking about the need for a fiscal spending, a fiscal bump. Certainly with lower GDP growth in the US, they'll be talking about the need for a fiscal bump. Japan has already announced that they're going to need that they are introducing a fiscal bump, and there is quite a strong likelihood that China will also do the same. Well, then the liquidity that this market has been relying on has been largely funded by central banks, and it could potentially be funded by both central banks and governments over the next couple of years. So, you know, in the period before the credit crisis, we had synchronized global economic expansion, and there is a likelihood that we could be moving into a point where we have synchronized global monetary expansion. And if that is indeed the case, then there is the prospect that Wall Street does sustain its upward break. And I think part of the reason that the stock market on Wall Street hasn't been improving upon that breakout over the last week has been because of oil prices. Because oil prices, despite the fact that the dollar was weaker in here today, they were still weak. And you know, generally speaking, when you get a weak dollar, and particularly in a dynamic fashion, then you get a bounce in commodities. You certainly got a bounce in commodities in the precious metal sector in here today, but not in oil. And of course, the reality is that there is no shortage of oil. The idiosyncrasies of unconventional supply, the fact that hydraulic fracturing and unconventional wells have a very prolific early stage, which means that despite the fact that they cost millions of dollars to drill, that you get payback in a very short period of time. Now, they have a very quick peak in terms of their prolific output, and then they go into what is largely a terminal decline. What it means is that you get a lot of oil very quickly if you drill, and that your supply of oil trails off quickly if you don't drill. And therefore, the supply from unconventional wells, which are largely onshore US wells, is very elastic relative to price. And therefore, when prices got up towards $50, then a lot of the wells that had been drilled but hadn't been brought into production were brought into production. That helps supply to increase, and that helps prices to come back down. Now, when you get the kind of move that we have had, and you just take away all of the fundamentals, that when you have an accelerated decline and a type 2 reaction against the prevailing trend, then the most likely scenario, and the thing that we see most often, is a period of right-hand extension, where you get an extremely volatile range, where you can get trough to peak swings in the order of 100%. And the rally that we've had in oil from trough to peak so far this year has been in the order of almost 100%. Well, then, we could be in an environment where oil prices remain weak, and more particularly remain volatile. A number of the companies in the oil sector have rallied spectacularly, and when you look at, for example, ExxonMobil, then it has pulled back quite sharply in here this week, so that investors are beginning to get the message that the uptrend in oil has broken, that we are in for a more volatile period of trading, and that this is perhaps not the best time to be investing, but rather to bide one's time, because if we do get a volatile environment, it means that it will turn into more of a trader's market. And that means that we're getting a rotation. And if something is coming down, well, then what is the thing that people are rotating into? And then it is sort of worth looking at. It is the kind of companies that have got the strong dividends, the global businesses, very recognizable franchises, and then more particularly those types of companies tend to be dividend aristocrats. And one of the sectors, among the sectors that did best after the Brexit referendum, were those kinds of companies. And then it was utilities, and it was pharmaceuticals. It was the kinds of companies that haven't really done much for a while, and but do have both high yields and also have these records of increasing those dividends. Well, when pharmaceuticals began to take off, that got people, I think, interested once more in the healthcare sector, and now we're seeing biotech really starting to garner additional interest. And the number of shares within the biotech sector that are breaking their respective medium-term downtrends and returning to outperformance is increasing. And it would suggest that a low of medium-term significance has been found. And of course, the very big difference between biotech today and biotech in the late 1990s is that they do have products. Those products are in the market, and they are generating money. And that is perhaps the most important factor of all, that the evolution of healthcare and biotech is at that stage where commercialization is real. So we can anticipate that that is going to have a direct impact on productivity, that more of the diseases that are chronic conditions will be able to be treated or avoided, and that will help to enhance the productivity growth of the wider economy, that there really is a transformative effect that can be generated from improving trends in healthcare. So that's something that could help to drive the future of economic growth. I know that I've spent the majority of the time in the audio so far talking about the risks, talking about the problems, but that would be to ignore the fact that low energy prices on average enhance economic growth. That when prices are low, it takes time, of course, but we've all been conditioned over the last 15 years to be economical, to drive efficiencies in terms of energy consumption. But when energy prices are low, then it takes a while. But eventually what happens is that people forget about the efficiencies and they start thinking about how they can use more energy because prices are low. And that helps to drive economic growth. Well, then if we have the evolution of the energy sector, and it isn't just, of course, that you have unconventional elastic supply, but that you're getting enhancements in solar and wind, that there is the very real prospect that somebody will crack the fusion nut in the not-too-distant future, that there are news stories abounding about I saw one just last week talking about that they have discovered another natural supply of hydrogen, and Toyota having led the market with the development of the Prius electric hybrid vehicle are now developing hydrogen fuel cell cars as well. So then there is the real possibility that we are at peak demand for oil, that with the evolution of hydrogen, solar, batteries, and electric cars, that we could be at peak demand. And then that's enormously beneficial, since we spend so much of our money on energy. And if we also have improving technology, improving healthcare, and the availability of that technology all over the world almost instantaneously after it has been released in one country, then we have the potential for productivity growth elsewhere. And of course, we're going to have an additional 2 billion consumers, because they're not just going to be 2 billion additional people, they're going to be 2 billion additional consumers, for the simple reason that governance is improving in high population countries. And that is perhaps the most profound change that we've had in human history, that governments really are delivering on improving standards of living for the majority of people on Earth. And if they can also benefit from availability of technology and low energy prices, then those are the kinds of trends that really can form a secular bull market. And then the question that we've had for much of the last decade, because anybody with eyes could see the imbalances that central banks were creating, and it was really only then a question of whether you could have a secular bull market before interest rates are normalized, or that a secular bull market takes off, which is fueled by monetary largesse, and that eventually peaks when interest rates are normalized. And of course, you know, it is worth considering that this uptrend on Wall Street has been going since early 2009, and we're halfway through 2016. That there isn't any real sign yet that interest rates are going to be normalized, and therefore, and what we do have the prospect of is that a good part of the world is going to be engaged in monetary profligacy for the foreseeable future. So then there is the potential that it is the supply of money from central banks is the liquidity provider that helps to drive the evolution of a secular bull market, and that when it is eventually normalized, it will be an inhibiting factor to the continuance of a secular bull market. That is perhaps a different way of looking at this problem, because when you have an index like the S&P 500 that has been going sideways for a year and a half and it breaks out, well, then you would need a clear downward dynamic to question potential for it to go higher. And of course, if we are moving into a period of synchronized monetary expansion, then the potential for assets that cannot simply be lent into existence, that becomes really quite attractive. So gold prices continue to look like that this is a bullish consolidation within a medium-term bullish environment, that platinum is now leading on the upside, that gold shares are offering leverage to the gold price, and that this is a bull market overall, for the simple reason that people need some form of safe haven for the to protect themselves against the very real outcome that some central bank somewhere is going to make a big mistake, and that we are going to have a hyperinflation environment at some point in the future, and that in that kind of environment, gold becomes really attractive. So it is one of the only assets that is not testing its all-time high at present, and therefore represents value. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and wish all the best to all of you.